I'm very pleased to welcome someone who many of you will know, Bradley Coon. I'll let him introduce himself, and he's going to talk about copyleft and the GPL and its role in defending our right to repair. Over to you, Bradley.
Thank you. I never thought of myself as a legend, so it's kind of you to say that, but I don't know if it's really accurate. In many ways, this will be an update of the keynote that I gave at FOSDEM 2017. I realize many of you may not have been to a FOSDEM from 4 years ago or whatever, more than 4 years ago, 6 years ago. If you didn't, I don't mind if you start clicking on the links. They're in my notes on the FOSDEM page, and you can click through those slides as I get started if you want the context, because my goal here is to kind of give an update on what's happened in the last couple of years. I approach all of the things in free and open source software from the role of an activist, which is frankly quite different from most of the kind of work that people tend to do. I am trained as a software developer. I spent many years doing software development, including proprietary software development once upon a time. And it's what turned me into an activist, such that I'm not doing so much software development, but instead trying to change the way that the technology industry works with regard to the rights that people have with regard to their technology. I really believe it's important, if you're an activist, to keep your goals and your area of activism narrow. It's not that I don't believe other causes are very important. Probably most of the causes that you would expect I am supportive of, I am. But I spend my time focused really narrowly on trying to reach a world where everyone has universal software freedom, or the phrase that I've been using a lot more to refer to it is a universal right to software repair. You should have the right to fix your software, and I want a world where everyone has that right for all the software that they use. As I get older, I become more and more morbid. I was already morbid, but now even more so. And not a week goes by that I don't think about the fact that this activist cause that I'm working on has basically no chance of succeeding in my lifetime. I will die in a world that most people in the world are using proprietary software for most of the things that they do with computers, and most people won't have the right to repair that software the day that I die. It's an unfortunate fact, but it's expected with regard to work as an activist. Ultimately, activism is not really just politics, although it feels that way most of the time. Most days, I end the day feeling like I'm some sort of politician, and I don't particularly like that feeling. But it's fundamentally different from politics, because politicians really seek only to achieve what is politically viable. And the art of politics is the art of compromising to a solution that everybody can agree on. But activists tend to, oh shoot, sorry. My colleagues are apparently talking about my talk and I'm getting notices about it. I think the big contrast to all of that in between activism and politics is that activism is really trying to reach something that's politically unviable, that really doesn't seem like it could ever happen. And the only similarity between the two really is that the goals are different, but the strategies tend to be the same. So as an activist, I have to find, and every activist needs to find, strategies that are politically viable, but those are not end goals in themselves. And it's a mistake to look at them as end goals in themselves. And if you look at my previous talks, you'll see I've talked about how copyleft is not an end goal in itself, it's a strategy to achieve software freedom. Now, being an activist, you often get insulted, as it turns out. I've been called many times to be tilting at windmills. I counted at least 10 times that's happened, either after one of my talks. And I actually always wonder if folks who have said that to me are actually have read the source material, or at least the Cliff Notes. Here is actually an excerpt from the Cliff Notes on the book Don Quixote. And I actually think it really explains activism quite well. Ultimately, acts of rebellion or reform are quixotic because the reformer aims to undermine the existing institutions in order to change them. And I believe that activism for software rights is designed to undermine the existing technology industry in order to change it. Copyleft is a strategy, a politically viable mechanism to bring about that change. Copyleft is subversive. Copyleft is quixotic. Copyleft is counterculture. Now, the interesting thing is that it also has to be politically viable, and we also have to succeed at using it to push forward the long-term, never happening in my lifetime goal of software rights for everybody. Now, one of the things that's made it incredibly difficult for Copyleft to continue to succeed, and I think it has had some success, but its success is in peril in recent years, is because of the level of co-option that we now see with regard to free and open source software. Co-option is a process that happens in social justice movements whereby the mainstream takes control of the politically viable parts of the otherwise idealistic activist cause and uses them to seek its own goals and usually supersedes the activists in time without tremendous work to fight against it. And you can actually look at the history of copyleft and really see that the technology industry has done a really good job of co-option of free and open source software, and copyleft has faced challenges as a strategy because of that co-option. Since 2001, almost every large big technology company has had some sort of strategy to discredit, undermine, or otherwise work against copyleft. You'll find that most big companies really, really love non-copylefted open source and free software, and they really dislike copylefted open source and free software. And this is not necessarily, it's reasonable that they take this position because copyleft is designed to undermine the technology industry. And they don't want it undermined. They want to continue to make proprietary software, and copyleft is attempting to prevent that. And I realize a lot of you probably work for some of these companies, and I suspect that last slide, for those of you in the audience who work for one of those companies or the many others that aren't on the list, that it creates a certain amount of cognitive dissonance. And I want to be clear that it's not your fault. You're part of a system, as am I, that has systemic institutionalized problems that take away people's rights to repair and improve their software. And no individual in the culture altogether can avoid this. If you take a look at the keynotes that Karen Sandler and I gave in previous years about the issue of trying to use only free software in your life, it's very, very difficult. So it's not necessarily a surprise that many people are going to be in a situation where they're both working for and against open source and free software at the same time. In the end, these are the systems, these systematic problems in the technology industry that are the windmills that someday the activist cause of universal software freedom will take down. But try to get comfortable with the cognitive dissonance that if you're doing work at a company, even if you're working on open source, but that company also does lots of proprietary stuff, you're both part of the problem and part of the solution at the same time. And I'm going to talk about a couple of things at the end of the talk that you can do to help. Companies have been paying attention to what copyleft does and how it works for a very long time, the entire history of copyleft, more or less. And this is the laundry list I came up with of the basically the playbook that companies use to keep copyleft from succeeding. It's relatively disturbing that that you'll find, for example, on GitHub, there for a while there was a GitHub employee who spent, I guess, their free time, maybe their paid time, not sure, going to various different projects that were copyleft and trying to shame them into changing their license to a non-copyleft license. I don't think that's occurring anymore, but it was one of the many examples I saw where there was real pressure from the corporate environment to shame people who chose copyleft, tell them their software was never going to be popular. And I've seen many colleagues who work for companies reassign from working on a copylefted project to a non-copylefted one, or who ask to have a project be released under copyleft to be told they have to release it under the MIT license or something else. It's very interesting to me, too, that there has been such pushback in the free software world about assigning copyrights to nonprofit entities that want to, you know, pursue this long-term goal of copyleft and software freedom, when most of the copyrights generated in software, open source and free software, are held by companies because your company keeps the copyright when you are an employee. And for Europeans, I'm talking about the exploitative right, and moral rights really tend not to come into play with regard to copyleft licenses. And what we've seen in my work doing enforcement and compliance with copyleft licenses is that really companies have become incredibly brazen in simply ignoring copyleft requirements entirely, or just promulgating interpretations that make no sense, saying that, well, that's what the source code is. Even though it's not the source code that they use, they make up a separate source release to give to you and claim that it corresponds to the binaries you received, but it doesn't in fact do that. So there's a lot of activities that folks who want to take away software freedom are using to succeed. Now, we've had a lot of success doing various different actions around copyright law to succeed in making copyleft work. I don't want this to sound like copyleft has been an unmitigated disaster. I think it's actually been quite successful. Howard Velta for years was doing enforcement in Germany that was very successful under copyright law. He's no longer doing that activity. The organization I work for, Software Freedom Conservancy, had a successful copyright litigation regarding the BusyBox project that did gain software freedom on a few devices. But we've learned a lot of lessons from doing copyleft as a copyrighted focused endeavor. The remedies that courts offer for copyleft, or for copyright rather, are not particularly well fitting with what we're trying to get done with copyleft. Typically, courts offer either injunction, which is a prohibition on further distribution of the software, and financial damages. Now, it's never been our goal to stop people from copying and redistributing copylefted software, so injunction tends not to be that interesting other than leverage to get compliance. And similarly, a threat of financial damages is not normally what activists want. I don't want money for copyleft infringement. I want compliance with the copyleft license. I want users to have the rights they were supposed to get in the first place. And there's no amount of financial reward that can ever replace the importance of having the right to modify the source code of your software. Additionally, any copyright action has to be brought by the copyright holder or someone they've assigned to. This creates a weird burden. I think Harold Velta was a true hero that he spent basically 10 to 15 years with probably half or 75% of his time just doing GPL enforcement to liberate Linux devices that had his code in it. But it's a lot to ask of any developer who would rather be writing code to have to go out and do these actions to get compliance with software that companies have violated the GPL on. So I've come to the conclusion, and many of us who do this work, that copyright was a pretty clumsy mechanism for getting what we actually want with copyleft. The goal of copyleft was to have a strategy that would liberate software for users. They would have the right to the source code would compile, the source code would install. But in the end, courts in copyright cases don't order entities to do the things that GPL says. So over the last few years, I've been thinking a lot about this quote that was actually the quote I put in my, in the US, you put it in your high school yourbook. It's when you finish your, before your post-secondary education, and you get to put a quote in your yearbook. And this is the quote I put in my yearbook, which I should have went back and read long before, because in fact, always trying to do copyleft enforcement as a copyright-based action was really a foolish consistency because other options were available. In fact, when you look at the GPL v2, the word you or your appears 93 times. 93 times it refers to what you are supposed to be allowed to do, what your rights are. The phrase copyright holder appears twice. The GPL and copyleft license in general have never been about the copyright holder. They're about you. They're about the user. They're about the person who received the software and what their rights are. Namely, their right to modify, repair, and reinstall the software. What the lawyers call this is they are third-party beneficiaries of the GPL agreement. And for various reasons that I can't get into because there's only 8 minutes left in my talk, we spent a lot of years only looking at copyright solutions and not looking at the third-party beneficiary solutions to getting compliance with copyleft and getting source code to users who were looking for it. At Software Freedom Conservancy, we currently have a third-party beneficiary case in the United States that is going quite well. You can read about it on our website against a seller of Linux-based televisions in the United States. And we're also engaged in some grant making to bring actions outside the US on a third-party beneficiary basis with regard to the GPL. I believe this is an important step that we have to take because we can't, as the English phrase goes, put all our eggs in one basket. Copyright-based solutions for copyleft are useful and they've succeeded in the past. But we shouldn't only be doing those. We should be looking at other mechanisms that we have in the legal infrastructure that we have for the defense of users' rights in software and using any of the mechanisms that we find, and really all of the mechanisms that we find. The other thing we're doing in the Visio case is we're asking for this thing that lawyers call specific performance. Now, specific performance is typically used for things like a family heirloom or some other type of object or thing that has no equivalent and no amount of money can replace it. Well, the fact is, we never felt that any amount of money could replace users' rights anyway, so specific performance is exactly the type of legal mechanism that we should seek with regard to getting the proper and correct source code for the devices that we have that contain GPL software. Furthermore, we don't even ask for financial damages. Our goal being that we're being very clear with the court what we want as activists. We want the right to copy, modify, and reinstall the software so that we can make use of it, so that we can take these computers, which just look like televisions, and use them for other purposes, like every other computer was 20 years ago. Today, most of our computers can't be repurposed. And usually they can't be repurposed because they're violating the GPL. That's something that we want to change. Now, there's a lot of stuff that you can do to help with this. I know I fed you some cognitive dissonance early, but there's real steps you can take if you're employed doing open source and free software development. I mentioned that companies tend to require their employees to effectively assign their copyrights. Usually it's part of your employment contract. Now, I realize if you're unemployed and desperately looking for a job, you don't have a lot of leverage. But most people in the technology industry switch jobs voluntarily. I ask that when you switch your jobs voluntarily, make it a term and condition of your new employment, that you get to keep your own copyrights, that you can decide when your software should be copylefted or not, instead of letting your employer decide that for you. As I said, we still will need to pursue copyright-based solutions to open source and free software issues with regard to copyleft. So having your own copyrights is a useful thing. And if you're willing, you can assign them to SFC, because I don't think it should then on top of that be your job to go out and figure out how to get compliance with the copyleft license after you've done all the hard work to get it released under a copyleft license. SFC is one of the organizations that's willing to do that work for you, and we're prepared to do it. You can also help on these two, and we have a new program that I'm announcing today at SFC that will hopefully really make it possible for you to make real progress in dealing with these issues. We're launching this new thing called Use the Source. Use the Source is designed to be a program where we can teach you and mentor you and get you involved in the process that we do to deal with all these millions of embedded devices that are violating the GPL. We've, as FOSS developers, have taken a FOSS development approach to it. We want a solution where volunteers can check the Office for Source, because almost every device that you've bought in the last 5 years probably is based on Linux and probably has an Office for Source. So with the Use the Source community, you can post any source requests that you've made, submit whatever the company gave you, and work with the rest of the community to figure out how to get it to build. Because the big problem is that most of these companies are not actually giving the right source code. They are not giving you the scripts used to control compilation and installation of the software, which the GPL2 has mandated since 1992. You have so much power as consumers and users of these devices to put pressure on these companies that are constantly telling us, oh, it's going to take us 6 months to get you the source code. Oh, well, that's an old product and we don't have to give you the source code. Not true. So I want to and would like you to join with my colleague Denver and I to learn how to verify these source releases. It really harkens back, if any of you were on Harold Velta's mailing list in the early 2000s, on gplviolations.org, they're now defunct, but if you look back at those archives, you'll see that's what people were doing in the early 2000s to try to get companies into compliance as a collaborative effort. We want the issues of copyleft to be something that operates like an open source and free software community, and I hope that you'll join us in doing that. So this was really scheduled to be an update from my previous talk, so I'm going to finish up there. I don't have a lot of time for questions. However, we have the legal and policy dev room that's happening this afternoon. There will be lots of discussion of issues related to copyleft there, and I'll be there along with my other colleagues who work on this kind of stuff, that you can ask questions there. Use the Source was launched today, and so you can take a look at the website and read more about it there. And I hope you'll donate to become a sustainer. We're a nonprofit charity that we operate based on your donations, and I'd really appreciate it. And with that, I think I'm completely out of time. I'm sorry I can't take questions, but please find me later.
Thank you very much, Dave Bradley.